Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Bill Summers, president of the Permaculture Credit Union in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Though I'd heard about the Permaculture Credit Union before, I didn't get around to looking into it further until Wes Rowe, one of the board members of PCU, contacted me with a suggestion. In setting up the interview, I spoke with Bill at length and felt his background offered a unique perspective to discuss banking and financial permaculture. He's been involved in finance and business for over 30 years, including holding a Master of Business Administration degree from Loyola College. Here is a banker who also practices permaculture. This interview adds another model to those presented by Eric Tonesmeyer and Lisa Fernandez on applying permaculture more broadly, particularly to business. As usual, we begin with Bill's background in the world of banking and finance and how he came to permaculture. From there, we move to the Permaculture Credit Union, how the organization began, the process involved to get started, which included some trials and tribulations, and the ethos that allows people to join the credit union, which also binds them together philosophically. Throughout it all, Bill speaks with clarity and frankness as I seek details on the credit union, how it operates, and also in a discussion about the financial crisis, meltdown, Great Recession that began several years ago, and we seem to still kind of be in the doldrums of at the moment. We throw some numbers around and touch on esoteric ideas behind what makes a particular financial institution secure or insecure. We close out talking about how community-focused banks can make a difference to the people that live in the area they serve, even if the bank is located hundreds or even thousands of miles away. In the information age, physical location may matter less and less, but we should ally with those groups who agree that the best place to start building a better world is at home, in our neighborhood, and our nearest town or city. If you like this interview, or any other episode of the Permaculture Podcast, please consider making a donation. It's through the support of listeners that I'm able to make improvements to the show and continue to produce episodes such as this. Find out more by visiting thepermaculturepodcast.com and clicking on the support tab. While you're there, you'll find ways to connect with me on Facebook or Twitter. Liking or following the show also helps to spread the word with others, as does leaving a review on your favorite podcast site, such as iTunes. You'll find out about that and much more at the support page. Now then, on to the interview with Bill Summers. I'll join you again afterwards with a few thoughts. Can you give us a little bit about your background, how you came to banking, and then how you found this strange world of permaculture?
I began in banking and finance back in the Midwest in Chicago. Started in consumer finance and wound up working my way into student loans. And then I went from there in Chicago to the East Coast, where I began to work for Sallie Mae, which was the student loan secondary market. And when I was at Sallie Mae, I worked with banks all over the country to work with them on operational things, originating loans, servicing loans, and obviously selling loans to Sallie Mae. So I was working with both banks and credit unions around the country. And at the same time, my wife was working. We were living in Northern Virginia, and my wife was working for a bank actually up in Philadelphia, where she would commute up there. She would go up there Monday morning, come back Friday night. And we did that for a couple of years, where I was traveling around the country working with banks and credit unions, and she was commuting back and forth between Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. At some point in time, we both decided this was just too frantic, and we decided to get out of banking completely. And so we both left our jobs and bought a small little company in Northern Virginia. And over the next 5 or 6 years, it only had 2 or 3 employees when we got there. And when we left, well, we actually sold it. I think we left, there were like 15 or 20 employees there at the time. From that point, we decided to not live in that crowded area directly outside of Washington, D.C., and wound up looking for a new place to land. We landed here in Albuquerque. We were looking in the southeast and in the southwest. And we visited Albuquerque, fell in love with it, and moved out here. And once we were here, I got involved in, actually there was a tribe on one of the reservations that had a housing authority that had gotten into making their own loans and had kind of, I'll say, messed it up. So they were looking for somebody to straighten it out. So I went out to one of the reservations and worked with a loan portfolio out there, and eventually was hired as the executive director for the entire housing authority. And it occurred to me, once I was out there on the reservation and saw the situation from a housing perspective, from a financial services perspective, that they really needed a local or local access or more access to financial services. It seemed to be a natural to me that since we were renting homes to, we had a couple hundred homes that we rented and managed out on the reservation, that we could really use other credit opportunities for them or make them available. In New Mexico, I don't know if New Mexico is unique, but they have something called title loans and payday loans, which is the common access to credit for a lot of the reservations. And those loans range in the area of 250 to 300% interest. And they roll over every 2 weeks. And a lot of people get in a lot of credit trouble that way. And I began to research options from a community development perspective on what we could do. So I wound up developing what's called a CDFI, which is a community development financial institution. And it's supported by the Treasury Department. Those organizations are intended to provide services to underserved populations. So I figured it's a natural combination, a housing authority and a CDFI. So we started that up and started making consumer loans to folks on the reservation. And realizing that the reservation, it was remote. It's about 800 square miles, the area of the reservation, about 40 miles by 20 miles. And there were no financial institutions available, you know, on the reservation. So we were it from a consumer perspective. So it gave everybody a really nice opportunity, alternative, let's say, to the payday loans. And that went very well. But one of the drawbacks to CDFIs is it's not a depository institution like a credit union or a bank is. And so I was always in search of additional funds. And over time, you know, it grew. We did well, and it was very useful to the community. And then I heard about the position here at Permaculture Credit Union. It seemed to be the natural, what I was looking for. It's the combination of an institution that has a very strong orientation towards community development, has philosophical, strong philosophical underpinnings, you know, care of the earth, care of people, and reinvesting the surplus. And it's a depository institution. So it was kind of everything what I thought was the perfect situation. If you were going to really be driven by the impact you want to make in the community, is to have all those resources available. So that's kind of my circuitous route from Chicago to Washington to Albuquerque and now to Santa Fe.
And working at the Permaculture Credit Union, have you gone through a PDC?
Yes, I have. In fact, Scott Pittman taught it. It's a little bit different than I think than the standard. Many of them are, you know, 2 weeks straight. That's difficult to do, for me anyway. And Scott and a couple of other teachers held one in Albuquerque early 2011. Yeah, early last year in the first quarter. And it was over a four-month period. So, yes, I have gone through that process.
Having gone through that process with your background in business and finance, has that changed your outlook as you work at the Permaculture Credit Union?
Has it changed it? It has strengthened it, I think. I was already oriented. See, one of the things, part of the discussion that I had, even before taking the PDC, in discussing with the board before I was hired and doing my research beforehand, I was somewhat familiar with permaculture, and I see what I would offer to bring to the picture is to simplify, from my perspective, permaculture is an environmental sustainability approach. Granted, you know, it's the design approach, and I realize all the aspects of it, but just for the purposes of this discussion, we're going to say that's an environmental approach to sustainability, whereas like the CDFI and what I think the credit union can do is the other side of the equation is the financial sustainability. It kind of connected those two for me. The credit union can bring the financial sustainability to individuals by serving them, and this might be an oversimplification or an exaggeration, by not approaching every market or every product or every individual, attempting to extract as much as we can from the situation, but looking at it from the perspective of how can we bring about a positive impact in that same environment. That's where I saw these, the two pieces coming together, even though there is a discussion, obviously, as part of the PDC, about invisible structures. So there is a consideration there, but I look at it, I kind of brought the operational side to it, or the market side to it, from a financial perspective. It was a really interesting process to go through. One thing that the PDC did for me, though, because I wasn't oriented towards permaculture prior to this, I didn't have a background in that, is apart from the financial side and apart from my job and apart from what I'm trying to accomplish here at the credit union, is it really informed me on the environmental side, which was eye-opening to me.
And then the impact that bringing the market side into the environmental side, the changes that could be made by marrying those two models?
It brings resources to the table, in my opinion. Again, getting back to the CDFI and other community development finance initiatives, is that so often they're utterly dependent on continuous donations to support it. And I see the credit union as an opportunity to, just through that natural course of business, again, reinvesting the excess. I mean, we operate the credit union, even though we're a nonprofit cooperative, this is still operated like a for-profit business. At some point, there are going to be excess profits, funds generated that can be reinvested in permaculture-oriented programs so we can actually support them, not only deliver them, which is what we're doing now, in partnership with other institutions and organizations.
I'd like to follow up on that idea about how that opens up potential, but before moving in that direction and going down that road that would lead us so far away from the credit union itself, why don't you give us a little bit of information about the credit union, how it operates, how it came to be, and the work that you're doing?
Sure. The organization was conceived probably about 15 years ago, the mid-90s. There was a group of permaculturists here in Santa Fe that realized at that point, and realized in 1995, 1996, 1997, you were still 10 years away, over 10 years away from the recent, relatively recent financial meltdown. And the Occupy initiative and all of that. And they realized back then that financial services that were available really weren't appropriate. And so they got together and said, we really have to create an alternative, an appropriate alternative from a permaculture perspective. And so they spent 5 years, or a group of like 8 or 10, and many of them still live here in Santa Fe. In fact, I try to stay in touch with all of them. But they got together and said, we're going to create a financial institution, and spent 5 years doing that, working with the state chartering agency and with the NCOA, National Credit Union Administration, which is the organization that oversees us and provides the deposit insurance. We have the same setup as any other bank or credit union. We're state chartered by the state of New Mexico, and we're federally insured. So the process they went through was extraordinarily time-consuming, and it required a lot of work. They actually had 5 separate applications that they submitted to NCOA. They'd send an application in, and it'd get rejected and sent back, and then another application would go in. And after 5 attempts, realizing that this credit union is unique in that your typical credit union is defined, what they call the field of membership is defined geographically or organizationally, meaning that pick your county credit union, and let's say the field of membership is defined, anybody who lives in this county can have an account at this credit union. Okay, that's one option. The other option is everybody that works for this organization, you know, IBM Federal Credit Union, things like that, or Intel Credit Union here in Albuquerque. Anybody who works for Intel or IBM and their relatives can have an account with that credit union. I'm sure everybody's familiar with those two approaches. The third approach that were taken by the founders here was neither of those, which is what threw so many people, both at the state level and the federal level. And their approach was neither geographic nor organizational. It was philosophical. And our field of membership is defined in one of three ways. Individuals that have taken a permaculture design course, individuals who are affiliated with the Permaculture Institute, or individuals that agree with the permaculture ethics of care of the earth, care of people, and reinvesting the surplus, which is a completely different approach and actually groundbreaking. If you think about it, what that means is anybody in the country who meets one of those three criteria can be a member here. And it took a lot of time and effort for them to convince the state and federal regulators to accept that concept. Between, say, 1995 and 96, up to 2000, they worked at this. And finally, in March of 2000, the state charter was granted. Here in New Mexico, that charter has been the only charter granted in the last 40 years for a credit union. So you can see it's quite an effort, first off, to even get a credit union chartered, and secondly, to bring to the table absolutely unique approach to defining the field of membership. So given all of that, where we stand today is March of 2000, charter in hand, we had zero members and zero assets. As of today, we have about 1,100 members and between 5.75 and $6 million in assets. It sounds like a lot in financial services. We're still considered very, very small. But we're growing. We're advancing on a yearly basis. We are still not full service, what you would consider a credit union, you know, with checkings and savings and debit cards and credit cards and this and that. We do have a range of savings accounts or share accounts, you know, a regular share account, and then we have share certificates or CDs, which are multi-year arrangements. We're just beginning to roll out a credit card. We don't have a debit card. That's something we're working up to. And on the loan side, we have typical consumer loans, signature loans, car loans, what we call a member-assisted loan, where one member can work with another to help them get a loan. I think one of our more interesting products is a program of microloans for organic farmers here in New Mexico. We've partnered with the Santa Fe Farmers Market and the New Mexico Farmers Market Association, or the Permaculture Guild and the New Mexico Farmers Market Association, to deliver microloans, $5,000 and less, as a rule. They can go up to $10,000, but those are exceptions. Anything over $5,000 is considered an exception. Anything below $5,000 is fairly typical. It's a credit offering that, for the most part, a lot of the small organic farmers, for any number of reasons, couldn't qualify if they weren't working through this program. And we've done over 100 of those, maybe 125 of those, in the last 4 years with great success. Great. We've brought about a lot of positive impact because it makes credit available, makes funds available to small businesses so they can grow their business. An example I use quite often is $3,000 loan to build a greenhouse, which in this particular case took the farmer from, you know, starting their plants literally on their kitchen table before the growing season, being able to move into a greenhouse and being able to, in this case, almost triple their output, which is a significant positive impact. And of course, over that period of time, the 100 or 125 loans we've made, only one of them has gone south on us, where it wasn't repaid. So it's been a positive impact both from a straight line of business for us, though not in huge dollars, $3,000 or $4,000 a piece. It's not, you know, it's not something you're going to base an entire organization on. But it's sustainable from a financial perspective, and it brings about a great deal of impact from a community development perspective, which is extraordinarily important to us as an organization. I think we're, in addition to the way our field of membership is defined, I think that we place equal emphasis on the financial return we receive in order to make it sustainable, as well as the impact on the borrower and the community. I think weighing those equally is a very unique approach for your typical financial institution. So that gives you an idea of where we stand today.
It's quite an overview of both where you began and where you are now. Coming from that, one question that arises, you didn't join the credit union during the recent financial meltdown, did you? You came in afterwards?
I came in afterwards, yes.
Okay. Can you speak generally about how the credit union weathered that event after the fact?
The impact of the financial meltdown, it was pretty minimal from what I've been able to see. Our membership is, best way to say it, is they're very financially conservative membership. So it wasn't as if there were a whole slew of loans go bad. We have some of the most conservatively financial, well-paying being that everything is paid on time. In fact, reviewing the credit card program that we're starting up now, we're actually replacing an existing program that has existed since, I believe it was begun in 2004. There are a lot of inquiries and requests from members, realizing that that was, 4 years in. A lot of members were inquiring about availability of credit cards, and the organization was much too small at that time to get into that. So what happened was a partnership was created between Permaculture Credit Union and a group of credit unions and Illinois Credit Union League out of the Midwest. The deal was we would refer people to Illinois Credit Union League, ICUL, and they would process and lend. I mean, they had their own credit card program that was constructed just for the PCU. And credit cards were generated, credit card loans were made, credit card accounts were created, and the Permaculture Credit Union name was on the credit card. But we had no financial interest in it. We didn't fund it. We didn't make the credit decisions. We didn't make the collections. We didn't do anything. It was just a referral process. Well, when I got here about a year and a half ago, it struck me that that would be a nice thing to bring in-house, where we would become the lender. We would make the credit decisions. And I began to do some research, and I discovered that that portfolio, that the payment history for all the cardholders was extraordinarily good. Take your typical credit card portfolio, about 10 to 15% of the cardholders would pay their balance in full every month. In ours, it was north of 50%. Folks were using them more for almost like debit cards than anything else. No, using them to transact and then just paying the balance in full every month because no interest is paid, which is, as you can see, it's completely different from your typical credit card portfolio. Using that as the example of the conservative approach of our members overall, that was reflected in the impact. You know, if you have a conservative membership, you have a relatively conservative financial institution from a lending perspective, that positions the organization overall to be able to weather situations like the financial meltdown pretty well. The only resulting impact from all of this is actually outside of, there's a couple of things. There are a couple of things outside of our control. One, as you know now, interest rates are at a historically low level. And in order to kickstart the economy, they're going to be kept there. The projection now is into 2014, 2015, which does impact us from a revenue perspective because we have any number of outstanding loans at a variable rate. So those rates are very, very low. The second impact, again, outside of our control, is that the whole deposit insurance mechanism, the pool that exists for all the credit unions, it's funded by the credit unions, always has been, and NCUA administers it. And there were a number of credit unions that didn't weather the financial meltdown very well and wound up going out of business, which then, as a result, the deposit insurance fund was tapped to make whole all those depositors. Well, now we are in the process of replenishing that fund. So we get assessed every year a fee of thousands of dollars that we have to pay that we didn't contribute to the problem and we didn't tap into the insurance fund, but now we are being charged on a yearly basis to replenish it. So from the impact perspective, I would say of everything surrounding the 07, 08, 09 financial problems, the biggest impact on the credit union here, despite our minding our P's and Q's during the entire process, is that we have this ongoing charge to replenish the National Credit Union Deposit Insurance Fund.
And that winds up just being one of the costs of doing business in this way, by being part of the NCUA and being organized as a credit union?
Exactly. But in our case, it's really impactful, because one of the things that you have to do as a financial institution is you have to maintain a capital cushion. Basically, it's a rain, oversimplified, but it's a rainy day fund. It's a cushion against something bad happening. 100 of your loans, none of them are paid off. Well, you have to have a cushion to accept those losses. And it's been a constant battle since day one for the organization to continue to build up that capital cushion. What happens is if that capital cushion doesn't continue to grow, then we can't bring in more deposits to make more loans, to add to the capital cushion, to bring in more deposits. No, that's a cycle. And that's been one of the constraints. There's only two sources of funds for a capital cushion, and that is either profits or just outright capital contributions. As we have tried to, since I've been here, trying to build that capital cushion, having this capital outflow every year, completely out of our control, has really gotten in the way of our being able to grow.
And then that's a combination of being limited on the way that you can contribute to that fund, and then these additional payments that you have to make that you never had to tap into. Your deposit insurance kind of siphons off some of that money that you could be using to grow that cushion.
Oh, sure, exactly. I mean, as an example, in starting the CDFI, what they call a lightly regulated financial institution, I mean, the Treasury Department's involved. When I began that fund, I was receiving grant funds from the Treasury Department, and I was paying the salaries for the CDFI fund out of the Housing Authority. I was providing office space. I was providing equipment, everything that was needed, and I also added almost $500,000 in capital up front, just so they could get going. It's kind of startup funds. It's like with any small business. Here's your startup capital. Well, going back to, as I said earlier, the year 2000, starting here with zero capital and zero and no members, it's literally been a start from ground zero to try to build this. And so this outflow has really kind of hung us up as far as being able to get off this growth plateau, so we can continue to expand our product offerings. And that's the reason why this 8-year process of having a referral credit card program as compared to being able to bring it in and keep it in-house. It's just a very slow process. Basically, for a small business, which we are, we're a little undercapitalized, was what it turns out to be.
And when you and I were speaking for some of the background for this interview, you addressed like what your critical mass is for where you can really grow. Could you go ahead and share that number with us and what kind of a difference that would make for the credit union once that happens?
Sure. If you view it from the perspective of a startup, you start up a business, you have a break-even point from a profit perspective. Now you have so much overhead cost, fixed overhead. Once you turn the lights on and rent the space and pay all the insurances and pay everything, buy the equipment, everything else, you basically have a fixed amount you have to exceed. And we're about $6 million in assets right now. And our break even from an income perspective, or from a portfolio size or asset size perspective, is between $10 and $12 million. To give you an idea, at $6 million, let's say for the sake of discussion, that in this day and age, in fact, you can look it up on the NCUA website where we submit our financials on a quarterly basis, our gross margin, and I'll round up for the sake of simplicity, is about 5%. So a gross margin being what's earned on the loans we have outstanding. And for the sake of discussion, we'll say that 80% of our assets are lent out. So it's $6 million. 80% of our assets are what would be about $4.8 million. And if our gross earnings on that $4.8 million is 5%, what is that? About $240,000. So that's our total income that we have to work with. And from that, we operate everything, pay all the rent. We pay all the insurances and the dividends that we pay on the share accounts and on the share certificates and everything else. I estimate that we need to be more in the $350,000 range or $400,000 range. So at about $10 million, with about 80%, again, of our assets being lent out, for the sake of discussion, we'll say, again, our gross is about 5%. That's exactly where we'd hit break even, where we would be able to continue to expand our product offerings and be able to continue to contribute to our capital cushion on an ongoing basis. We kind of lift the lid off, let's say. The lid that exists now because of our lack of capital cushion, that would be gone completely. And we'd become sustainable.
That was my next question, was that at this point, the credit union is functioning and operating with a profit and continuing to grow slowly, but you could really make a serious reinvestment in the organization and kind of take off once you reach that 10 million point.
That's exactly it. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, not today, but previously, and I've mentioned any number of times, there are situations that we encounter now when we have a lot of supporters around the country that want to deposit funds, and there are some substantial depositors that we can't have as customers right now because that would negatively impact what we call our capital ratio or the percentage of total assets to our capital cushion. So once we hit that point, as I said, about the $10 million range, there wouldn't be any end in sight at that point. We could bring in, I mean, not unlimited deposits, but reasonably speaking, we wouldn't have to turn away any more depositors, and we could begin to really expand the credit offerings that we can make. Like right now, we had to get out of the mortgage business because we didn't have, about a year ago, we were, I think, 97% lent out. So we just didn't have the wherewithal to make mortgages or even home improvement loans, which we'd dearly love to, from a weatherization perspective, or if someone wanted to add solar to their home. It's a program that I think is extraordinarily attractive, or water catchment, or any type of improvements like that. I think there's a great opportunity for us, especially within our community, quote unquote, the sustainable community. We don't have the funds to do that right now, despite the fact there's great demand for it.
And this problem arises if someone came to you today and said, I have $5 million that I would like to deposit with you, which will bring you over that $10 million mark. You couldn't accept that deposit because of this capital cushion issue?
Exactly. Now, if they came to me and said, I have $5 million to deposit, but I would like to donate 10% of that as a contribution to the capital cushion, in that situation, we would maintain that ratio, then we have no limit. They could come in and say, well, I want to deposit $100 million. Here's 10% of that, but we want to donate. And that way we would maintain that capital cushion. It's the distinction between the capital cushion and a deposit, realizing that the capital cushion, they are our funds. They're retained earnings and their contributions. A deposit is actually a liability to a financial institution. Because if you deposit $1,000 in the credit union, I owe you that $1,000. That's where a lot of people get caught up. And the neat thing, I'll throw in a quick plug, we did have a small fundraising effort early in 2012. And just to let you know, that tax-deductible contributions can be made to the credit union for the capital fund. So we have a fiscal sponsor called the Permaculture Guild that we also partner with on the organic loan program. A donation can be made to the guild that's tax-deductible. They're a 501c3. A tax letter would be sent out, and then that contribution can be deducted from your income for the purposes of income taxes. So say $100,000 donation. As a rule, I think that it's a rule of thumb. I think you get probably about a 30% tax benefit. Actually would be, when all is said and done, a $70,000 contribution, and then we can go out and bring in, for every $1 we add to our capital cushion, we can bring in $10 in deposits. So there's quite a multiplier effect there.
And then that ratio that you just addressed, my understanding is that was part of the problem of the most recent financial downturn, was because of, I guess, over-leveraging, that institutions were lending out a larger ratio than they should have in order to hold a proper capital cushion, if all that language sounds right.
Fundamentally, you're right. That's the prudence behind a capital cushion and an appropriate capital cushion, because you have to be able to allow for unexpected losses. And if you're out there, you know, I'll use an extreme example. You're out there making loans that you shouldn't be, which in any number of cases occurred on the mortgage side with financial institutions. And then you're right, you're over-leveraged. Over-leveraged meaning you don't have the underlying capital cushion to handle the downturn. Then you have a really significant downturn. Let's say half your mortgage portfolio, because you're out there just originating to originate for the sake of originating, just to generate more volume. And then let's say half of that portfolio doesn't pay off, and you don't have the capital. That's exactly what happens. The regulations we work under, while they do chafe at times, we have a lot of folks around the country and a lot of supporters around the country that would dearly love to put deposits in here, but we can't because of the capital constraints. Well, the capital constraints are there for a reason, and I agree entirely with the approach, even though it does kind of tie our hands a little bit. But that's what you pointed out is absolutely correct. It was irresponsible lending and over-leveraging. And you do that long enough, and the house of cards falls down. And that's exactly what happened. And now we're trying to recover from it.
While you were giving that rundown, what was going through the back of my head is there's a scene in It's a Wonderful Life where the members of the community come into the bank and they want their deposit money back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's George Bailey, James Stewart's character, starts talking about how the money isn't there. It's in, you know, your house and your house. It's in your business. And in this case, this downturn in the issue is that as those mortgages started to fail, there just wasn't enough money in the bank to cover those losses.
Exactly. Literally what happened in that situation is it was a run on the bank from a deposit perspective. In theory, we could encounter the same thing. If we were 100% lent out and every depositor came in here the day after and said they wanted to withdraw their funds, we'd be in the same boat. Any financial institution would be in the same boat. That's why we're continually balancing our liquidity meaning the cash not invested, but still deposits here. So that's distinction between capital and deposits. You know, the capital is ours. If we were lent out completely with no deposits remaining and everybody showed up to receive their cash, that would be the same as what was encountered in It's a Wonderful Life. We have to balance everything on an ongoing basis. Based on history, the demand for withdrawals and things like that, you have to maintain that on a daily basis.
Does that information come from historical data to give you a general idea of where to practice from? Is that something that actuaries break down in order to give you like a clear idea of what you need to do based on like the number of members that you have versus the amount of deposits and capital? And it's very technical, and there's a lot more going on behind the scenes in banking between these different layers of that you've described than I was aware of.
Every institution's different. There isn't one way. It's like viewing our credit card portfolio versus Wells Fargo's credit card portfolio. Our portfolio acts a lot differently, and our members act a lot differently. And you see that in the credit card portfolio. You see that in the institution as well. Our credit union members are less sensitive. They're more, the members of our credit union are interested in our business. They're interested in what we do. They're interested in knowing what we do. They're interested that our investment philosophy matches up to their investment philosophy. I'll say that our members, within reason, are less rate sensitive. In another institution, you could drop the dividend you're paying on deposits 0.25%, and you can see X percent of your deposits leave because someone's looking for that 0.25% elsewhere. Every one of our members, I believe, agrees with our philosophy that we should consider impact as well as return, and they act that way. I think from that perspective, we're also unique, and that even sets us apart from the other credit unions. The difference between banks and credit unions is the fundamental difference as a bank is stockholder-owned, and the stockholders want a return on their investment. A credit union, by definition, is a cooperative. Every depositor has ownership interest in the credit union. And by ownership interest, I'm not saying proportional to their deposit. I'm saying every member has a vote for the board of directors, whether you have $1,000 or $100,000 deposited here. Everybody has a vote. And that can impact the direction because the members choose the board of directors. The board of directors oversees the staff, including me, and that sets the direction of the organization. Our membership as a whole want us to operate in a certain way. And as a result, the financial interactions and how the ebb and flow of cash within the institution is, in my opinion, unique because of that.
Looking over some of the information that you provided me ahead of time, one of the things that surprised me was you list the default rate for your loans as a fraction of a percent. I think it worked out that like 1 in 250 loans default compared to the national rate where it's closer to like 1 in 20 or even 1 in 12 depending on what it's for. And looking at that and the microloan programs that you offer, I think of the work of Grameen Bank and Muhammad Yunus. I heard several interviews with him where he was talking about these microloans and these small loans really make a difference in the lives of the people who are seeking them. That engagement with the difference that that money makes seems to change the way that they perceive the loan and their responsibility to it and the people who made it to them. Do you find that that kind of a mindset with your members makes that difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's something that I have firmly come to believe. Because just generically, and I don't know how deeply you want to get into community development finance, but one thing I saw, and I thought it was unique with the CDFI on the reservation, where you have a community that they know the CDFI, that small little loan fund, was there just to serve them. And I used to quote, in fact, there were times I would close loans, and I would actually say to the person across the desk and say, this is a small fund we have available. We're making you this loan. If you don't pay this loan back, the next person that comes in the door, the funds aren't going to be here to lend them. There's a very strong community connection, and the entire community knew it. We were there to serve them. As a result, I had, if memory serves, I had less than a 1% delinquency rate on that. Not a default rate, a delinquency rate. In a community that was horribly underserved, horribly inexperienced because of their location and lack of access to credit overall, but there's a strong community connection between the institution and the community. What you saw in the numbers is the same thing here, in my opinion. in a completely different situation, completely different market, completely different products. Everything is different. But the one common denominator is the connection to the community. And it's not a geographic community in this case. In that case, it was. It was 800 square miles of pretty much not much anything but that. And that's defined the community. In our case, with PCU, to overgeneralize, I'll say it's the sustainable community and the participants in that community. And they know overall, because I don't know if I mentioned earlier, but we have members in 45 different states around the country, from Alaska to Hawaii to Florida to Maine and in between. So there's no obviously geographic connection, or anyway, close to geographic connection. But the community overall knows what our intentions are and our purpose, and the members actually control it in this case. So there's a much stronger connection to the organization. And as a result, I think that is reflected in the performance of the portfolios, both from microloans, with the, you know, we've only lost one out of over 100 of them, to the way the payment histories on the credit card portfolio, the same thing. It's a very financially conservative group overall that appreciates the products that are delivered and is interested in supporting the institution by making their payments.
When you mentioned that number of a 1% delinquency rate, we already know how the default rates compare to the national averages. How does a 1% delinquency rate compare?
You can have a 10% delinquency rate with a 1% default rate, meaning that 10% of the folks might pay late, but they eventually pay. There's no comparison. It's extraordinarily low. Most financial institutions would be doing cartwheels if they had a 1% default rate. When you have a 1% delinquency rate, 0.1% or 0.2% default rate, it changes the business dramatically. It changes the dynamic of a financial institution dramatically. Once we hit critical mass with that type of, and I consider that a support effort by the community. That's not, oh, they're obligated. No, they're obligated to pay their loans. No, they are actively supporting the institution by using our products and services responsibly and paying back on debts and things like that. And in some cases, winding up receiving a slightly lower return on, say, deposits. We're never going to be the highest return on deposits. We will stick to the middle of the road. There will be other institutions that offer higher rates or other institutions that offer lower rates. But overall, everybody will receive a fair rate on their deposits, and everyone will be charged a fair rate on their loan. I was watching something or read something this morning about, oh gosh, there's a new financial institution that's out on the web or something like that. They put title loans to shame at only 200 or 300%, where they're in the 500 or 600% in actual APRs they're charging. That's not something we'll ever do. We're not out here to, you know, extract as much from as we possibly can in fees and interest from our members. We're here to provide, I view it as almost a utilitarian approach. People need access to financial services these days. We offer fair financial services and pay a fair rate and expect a fair rate in return. And in exchange for all of that, especially in our situation where we don't have to have the brick and mortar that other credit unions and banks have to do, because we operate across the entire country out of a single office. When we reach a certain size, the money we don't have to invest in all the infrastructure will be able to be used, the return on that money or the proceeds will be able to be used in other ways to support sustainable interests that we haven't begun to approach yet from a community perspective, to come to the membership as a whole and say, okay, we've now reached this point and we are generating this amount of excess. How would you like that used? What efforts would you like to support with that? Would you like to put together a grant program? Would you like to secure, an example being, I'll just make one up, not unlike our farmers market loans that are secured through a partnership with the Santa Fe Farmers Market, would a community like to put together a loan fund for permaculture design courses or for sustainable vehicles. Or one of our loan programs that I didn't mention is we actually have a bicycle loan program. Not something I would suspect you can walk into Wells Fargo and get today, but we would only be limited by our imagination at that point on the impact that we could bring about in the community overall.
It's a pretty amazing method, and it's strange to me to think about what you're doing as something that seems so different, because I remember 25 years ago as a child going into the bank with my father, and he would go in and sit down with the bank manager, and they would have a conversation about what he wanted to do and what he could expect from the bank with trying to finance whatever project or vehicle or whatever other plan he had in mind, and that there was that human relationship there and that give and take, and that the bank was there as part of the community because there were only a couple of branches and you knew who everyone was, to moving to these larger and larger institutions where you might go in and sit down with the bank manager and talk with him about what you want to do, but they're still tied to the paperwork that they have to fill out and send back to corporate.
I would suspect that the institution you walked into 25 years ago was not a multinational corporation. I would even say, venture a guess, that they weren't even a regional corporation. I would suspect that they were more of a community development, or not a community development, but a community organization. Their focus was on, you know, that city or that county. And I would also guess that if it was a bank, that the investors in the bank were also from that same city or county. So they viewed their investment, I think, from the way that we currently view our operation. They were looking for a return on their investment, but they were also looking for the impact on the community. Nowadays, you have that same bank, wherever it might have been, I would suspect is now owned by at least a national, if not a multinational corporation, that for the most part, and this is my own opinion, could pretty much care less about the impact on the community. Their focus is on their rate of return. And so it changes the entire dynamic fundamentally between striving for monthly or quarterly returns to maximize them and using that as the sole measure for the success or failure of an organization, changes the way or the one-to-one interaction between the person that works in the financial institution and the customer. From my perspective and in my opinion, and having been in that type of banking myself about that time ago, I've seen it. I've been through it. I was a wholehearted participant in it for years. But once you kind of step away from that, then kind of come back in with a different perspective, and you're looking at it from a community perspective as well as a business perspective, it changes everything. Nowadays, I mean, back to use an example, there was a large bank up in the Northwest that when I was working with reservations, that there's a unique loan to make mortgages on trust land as compared to fee simple land. And they were the largest, far and away, lender in the country, nationally. Now, it wasn't a large program in the great grand scheme of things. It was like, I don't know, $200 or $300 million a year in mortgages. And literally, from one day to the next, they were in the program. The next day, they were out of the program. It was nothing more than an email. We are no longer making these loans. And here's hundreds of millions of dollars that would have been available for a really, really, really unique mortgage on trust land. And it just disappeared overnight. And having been in from a program and a product development perspective back when I was on the East Coast and I worked nationally, I could envision, I knew the discussion. Somebody somewhere, executive vice president, senior vice president, whatever it was, said, well, we're only doing $200 or $300 million a year, and it takes these 47 people to do that. Let's just can it because we're not making enough. I can turn that $300 million a year into, 6 or 8 or 10 commercial loans and have two people work on it. And I can get that much more of a return. That's where, in my opinion, financial services have gone in many situations. Banking, you know, products disappear just at the flick of a wrist with no consideration to the impact on the hundreds of thousands of people that can be impacted by that. But whoever made that decision may have gotten a bonus because their, you know, their stock price went up, or their return went up 20 basis points that year for the entire organization. It's the overemphasis, the only emphasis, the exclusive emphasis on rate of return that has changed the delivery of financial services all the way down to, you know, the conversations over the desk.
The way that you described my bank was very much the case, because it was a community bank with like 3 branches. And over the time, from, it was about an 18-year process, I guess, where it was bought out by one company that made it a little bit larger, then bought out by another. I think it was bought out 4 times before I finally left that institution. Mm-hmm. Because it became one where I had no deposit requirement. Like, I wasn't required to hold a certain amount of money in the bank, because it was just my first savings and checking account when I was a teenager, just to, you know, get a job and have a place to put money in things. And I just watched it as that changed. And then it went from a, you know, no minimum deposit to a $500 minimum deposit, to the point where when I first started my first job, they got bought out again. And I get the new letter that it was a $1,500 minimum deposit. And if I didn't have that minimum, they were then going to start charging me fees on top of that to store my own money with them. And that's when I finally made the move to a local credit union. But I watched my local community bank just 3 or 4 years ago get bought out again. So yeah, I can see how that process happened. And there was a conversation actually this morning before I got on to interview you, I was having with a friend who's considering buying their first house. And in that conversation, while we were talking about things, well, I wouldn't say that it became very clear to me, but the way that I was reading the conversation that we were having via email was that their cost-benefit analysis for buying the home was turning into one completely of dollars and cents. It was all about financial capital.
Mm-hmm.
And I wound up sending him then an article from a permaculture designer here on the East Coast, Ethan Rowland. He co-authored a paper on our 8 forms of capital, which looks at financial capital as one of those, but also our social capital, our intellectual capital, and these other ways that we interact with the community beyond just dollars and cents. And I sent that over to my friend so that it could expand the conversation beyond just, well, if I buy the house and I spend this much time to pay it off, if I were to use that money to invest somewhere else, you know, to kind of, let's look at the other benefits that are available should you go down this road, rather than just the money side of it.
Exactly. It skews everything. If that's the sole determinant of a successful investment or an unsuccessful investment, it's almost like looking at a permaculture site and stepping back. Let's look at all the effects. Let's look at all the influences. Let's look at all the inputs as compared to just picking one. I think a broader perspective is really required. I think my stepping out and stepping away from financial services for, what was that, 10 years or so, was very beneficial. But then also, it was also beneficial to visit reservations and to see the impact of the title loan lenders, 200 or 300% interest, and to see the impact on families running both the CDFI and the housing authority. I was able to see the impact on the homeowners or renters. And, oh, they can't pay the rent because they've got 3 title loans that they're paying, or payday loans that they're paying 300% interest on. And we turned around, and if we could send them down the hallway to the CDFI, where we'd lend them money at what would be considered an insane rate, say 15%. But it got them out of the hole, because you could put a couple of these title loans or payday loans together and keep rolling them over, and you can get into a hole you can't get out of anymore. And the resulting impact on families, in my opinion, that you see, especially on the reservation, where you're already starting with substandard housing in any number of situations. You're starting with overcrowding to begin with, and then you also throw financial insecurity into the mix. And I think it creates all sorts of behavioral problems that it just spirals out of control. Picking one thing, one characteristic out of anything and focusing exclusively on that isn't productive. I've never been able to completely intertwine or connect financial service, or financial sustainability, environmental sustainability, or permaculture, but there are areas of overlap. And the biggest one that I've seen is just the broader perspective and taking a broader design approach, considering more than just one thing, I think is much more productive in any activity. That's one of the things that I kind of anticipated coming into this job, is being able to do that and bring some financial resources to bear where they normally would not be.
How to make decisions and judgments beyond the scope of dollars and cents is something that I'm currently studying quite a bit about, as I'm studying natural resource law and policy. And there's a lot of discussion about, well, how do we value our natural resources? And many of the things that we've touched on in this conversation relate to a lot of what I'm encountering now in my current course of study. And it's something that I could probably go back and forth with you on and walk us down for a while. But I've had you here for a bit. We've run a little bit over where I normally bring things to a close. But I would like to have you back on sometime to discuss community developed finance. I think that that could serve as an important model for a number of people on relocalizing some of their economies and providing options for folks.
That's a discussion we have here during planning sessions. It's something I think about continuously. In my opinion, the word that I've been kind of mulling recently is global local, G-L-O-B-A-L-O-C-A-L, because in this day and age, an institution like ours is needed with the sheer mobility of everybody and how things are intertwined. So you do need a national platform, operational platform like we have, with our interaction in the electronic funds transfers, our having deposit insurance, our being able to operate in, as I said earlier, Maine, Florida, Alaska, and Hawaii, and everywhere in between all at the same time. But then also having a local orientation. What I would like to do eventually is take this, our local effort with the community development loan, in my opinion, which is the organic farmers market loan, I'd like to replicate that 150 times or 200 or 500 times around the country in different communities for different purposes. And it can be done. But that's where the community development comes in. I think it's extraordinarily important to keep those two things in mind and to be able to bring them together and not separate them and say, okay, that's a national platform, that's a transactional thing, that's a credit card, which can be delivered nationally as compared to a loan that can be, in this case, I don't want to take too much longer, but to point out that in the Loans for Organic Farmers, we actually restructured the entire application process to fit the recipients, as compared to our saying, here's the application process. It's not one or the other. It's bringing them both together because they benefit all the participants, both from a local perspective and a national perspective. And I think that's something that I'd really like to talk about more, but I think that's something that everybody has to keep in mind, that you can do both, but it requires, I think, what we have, which is the philosophical underpinnings and a very, very strong philosophical foundation of the organization. And to have that woven into the fabric of the organization so it can't go away, so it's going to be there forever. So there's a lot of opportunity when those two things can be brought together and kept together for the benefit of all the participants.
I think that brings us around nicely from the beginning of how this organization tries to make a difference and also how we as individuals moving forward can use these different models to make a difference in our own community and how to bring about productive change.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for your time today, Bill.
Well, thanks for your time.
I've taken quite a bit more than I expected, and we got a little technical and meaty there in the middle with my questions, just trying to figure out how this strange world that seems so disconnected from me anymore works with finance and all the obfuscation and strange myriad levels of it all. But thank you for clarifying that and bringing some and simplifying this process in a way that made it easier to understand.
I appreciate the time, and I'd be happy to talk another time.
I really appreciate that, and I'll be in touch then to set up a future interview.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot.
And that was Bill Summers, president of the Permaculture Credit Union. When he spoke of the low delinquency and default rates of the people that his credit union has lended money to, and how repayments of loans to a CDFI or credit union repays the whole community because another loan can be made, I started to think of community-supported finance, whatever its form, as a type of renewable resource. It begins as a pool of money is created that people can borrow from to make a difference in their own lives, then pay back, and allow someone else then to take another loan and do the same. As that pool of money grows, the community supporting the financial organization then gets to decide the best course of action for where that pool of money should go in the future to build towards a shared vision. What if this model got replicated everywhere? Instead of large banks controlling hundreds of millions or billions or, I don't know, are there any banks valued at trillions of dollars in assets? But whether they're dealing in dollars or pounds sterling or euros or rupees, instead of these really big values, that instead it was tens of thousands of banks controlling maybe 10 or 20 million each, with a keen eye to deliver improvements to the community served, rather than for ever-growing profits. Could a financial crisis like we experienced happen again if this were the face of banking, where no one is too big to fail and where the members are invested not only monetarily, but in that sense of a shared vision of the role of that bank? I don't know, but it makes me wonder. In the meantime, Bill and I are planning a follow-up interview sometime before the end of February 2013 to discuss community-developed financial institutions and community investment. If you have any questions for Bill to clarify something from this episode or for that next episode about community finance, please let me know. show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or 717-827-6266. The next episode looks like it's going to be a listener question about how a fully permacultured society would differ from our current agriculture and industrial model in responding to a disaster, such as an ongoing drought. Until then, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.